We'll hear argument next in case 07610, Locke versus Karas. Mr. Young.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case addresses whether the First and 14th Amendments permit public employers to compel non-union employees to subsidize a union's expressive speech of a political nature in a public forum. Specifically, litigation in courts and before administrative agencies not involving their bargaining unit. We submit that the answer to this question is no, a result supported by the Court's unanimous, unambiguous, and categorical holding in Ellis. In Ellis, this Court held that, to avoid constitutional problems, non-members under the Railway Labor Act could not be forced to subsidize any litigation not arising within their bargaining unit, not even litigation to enforce another bargaining unit's agreement in bankruptcy proceedings.
But, of course, they wouldn't be subsidizing it if indeed it is some kind of essentially an insurance scheme. They contribute to the national union, and in exchange, the national union defends their interests just as it defends the interests of other unions. You didn't address that pooling argument.
I would respectfully disagree, Justice Scalia, but my answer to your question —
It doesn't seem to be fair to call it subsidizing if, in fact, that's what's going on.
Well, it's also not fair, Justice Scalia, to call it insurance. It's affiliation, and the answer —
Well,
to the question,
I don't know, because that wasn't inquired into by the Court below. I guess we really don't know, do we, whether the local union can make any demands upon the national union for litigation defense?
Well, I think we can rely, Justice Scalia, on the admissions contained in MSEA's brief, which freely concedes that, in fact, SEIU has no enforceable obligations under its affiliation arrangement with MSEA.
Well, if we don't call it insurance, could we call it pooling?
Well, of course, that is what they call it, Justice Kennedy, and pooling is certainly something that we believe the Court rejected in Ellis when it set forth a categorical rule. The pooling argument was raised in the briefs in Ellis, and this Court did not see fit.
Mr. Young, I thought that in Ellis, the litigation, the Ellis Court said that litigation did not have as its subject matter negotiation or administration of a collective bargaining contract.
I don't believe that's the case, Justice Ginsburg, because Ellis dealt with enforcing a bargaining agreement.
I'm quoting from that decision at page 453. The case involved litigation not involving negotiation or administration of a collective bargaining contract.
Well, of course, Justice Ginsburg, the some of the litigation did involve enforcing another bargaining unit's agreement in bankruptcy proceedings. I don't know how that is not enforcing.
What are you saying, the Court got it wrong? The words that I'm quoting are from the opinion. Not involving negotiation or administration of a collective bargaining contract.
Well,
that's the only thing that could be germane. If it doesn't relate to that, then your case is solid.
Well, I'm trying to find the specific language, Justice Ginsburg, and I apologize for my inadequacy in this regard, but I think the point that we would rely on in Ellis, in the very paragraph you refer to, is the specificity with which this Court discussed what was chargeable. It referred to the contract, for instance. It referred to the exclusive representative twice, not an exclusive representative, but the exclusive representative. It referred to the bargaining unit not less than five times in that single paragraph in discussing what was permissible under the Railway Labor Act.
Do you want to stand or fall on the all-or-nothing argument that non-members can never be required to pay for any extra unit litigation expenses, or do you have an additional argument?
No, Justice Alito. We believe that the Ellis standard is the constitutional standard, as both principal opinions in Leonard discussed. Justice Blackmun specifically recognized it in his plurality opinion, and Justice Scalia himself said there was good cause to treat Ellis as stating the constitutional rule.
Well, do you take that as meaning that the union couldn't buy litigation insurance?
real insurance, Justice Souter? I think that would, obviously that would
some
be.
Some of those premiums are going to subsidize defense in cases beyond this bargaining unit. In fact, most of it will.
Well, but the distinction, Justice Souter, I think is discussed in the brief, amicus brief filed by Pacific Legal Foundation. For one thing, it would not be the labor union that would be another labor union receiving those insurance funds. It would be a third-party insurer, presumably. There would be
So in your view, then, even if the agreement with the parent union in this case involved an explicit obligation on the part of the parent to come in and defend, if litigation arose in this unit, that would still be bad.
It would add the insult of the.
Oh, I'm not interested in insults. Is it constitutional or isn't it?
We believe it would not be if the international affiliate were the insurer, Justice Souter.
Then, and you do take the position that a genuine insurance policy issued by an insurer would not violate the constitutional standard.
That is our argument, okay. Justice.
Even though there may be a great disconnect between the premiums and the needs of the particular unit. I mean, let's say the particular unit has always had a history of good relations with the employer. It has never had to call upon litigation in 20 years, and they don't anticipate it, and yet their insurance premiums rise dramatically because of very hostile and extended litigation by another unit. You concede that case?
I don't think I would concede the premise of your question, Mr. Chief Justice. And I think that point is discussed fairly thoroughly in Pacific Legal Foundation's brief. A rate setting in insurance context is radically different than the affiliation fee setting in this context. Rate and much more about insurance than, frankly, I know, but it's certainly.
Yeah, but it's based on the experience of the whole cohort of insureds.
It's also.
And the Chief Justice question says, can a local that is certainly on the basis of past experience not going to need this insurance nearly as much as other locals, can it enter into an insurance arrangement with other locals to buy the insurance for all of the locals, even though it knows that it won't benefit very much from that insurance policy?
I'm sorry, misunderstood.
That was he was trying to help you.
I'm sorry, Mr.
You should have said yes, Chief Justice. That was
And I appreciate the help, Mr. Chief Justice, and you're pointing that out, Justice Scalia. I misunderstood the question, and I apologize. Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. Our point would be, however, that in that type of relationship, and as I said, that's.
Does that mean that each time they buy an insurance policy, they have to investigate which locals are going to get the most benefit out of it?
Well, I don't think that's a position for the locals. That's the insurer setting rates, and I don't know of a market, quite honestly, Justice Stevens, for
but
that
you
type
give
of
one thing. Answer to the Chief Justice on the facts he gave, and a different one if the record showed that everybody got a proportional benefit out of the group policy.
I don't know, Justice Stevens. I don't think my answer would differ. I think, however.
So your answer doesn't depend then on the facts that he included in the question.
Well, he's not trying to help you.
I'm not sure he was either.
One looks for it where one can find it, Justice Stevens and Mr. Chief Justice. I think the distinction has to be made here between insurance on the one hand and affiliation. There, in the insurance context, you have.
Does that mean all insurance policies are bad?
No. I concede insurance, Justice Stevens. My point, if it is true insurance where there is mutuality of obligation, the difficulty that this Court, I believe, found in the Ellis case when it set a bright line test was that it was public, and I think can be discerned from the Court's other cases, including Glickman, is we're talking about public speech of a political nature in a public forum.
But there was mutuality of obligation in the hypothesis that I gave you, in which the agreement with the parent union required an affirmative obligation of the parent union to come in and defend if litigation arose, and you said that still would not be constitutional.
So the
criterion has got to be something other than mutuality of obligation, right?
And it assuredly is.
And what is it? What is the distinction, though?
The other distinction has to be that the problem also arises from the nature of the forced relationship. As this Court has recognized in cases such as Ellis and Abood, allowing the agency shop at all works an infringement on First Amendment rights.
We start with that premise, but what is the other distinction then, if it is not mutuality of obligation? What is the point that separates the sheep from the goats here?
Well, mutuality of obligation coupled with true rate setting in the sense that there is.
What is rate setting got to do with your basic point? Your basic point, as I understand it, is that some of the money that's being taken, from the local union and in our example subsidized by the service fee is being used to subsidize litigation for other unions. And that is, it seems to me, exactly true in the insurance case. Some of those premiums will subsidize litigation involving speech in other union bargaining aid. What's the distinction?
Well, the distinction, Justice Souter, would be that there is, it doesn't seem to me that there is a, there's a larger pool created than just a union litigation pool in the insurance context. Furthermore, the money, in fact,
I don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, if you buy labor litigation insurance, I suppose it is not. Don't they set their rates with respect to the experience in labor litigation, not on their experience with automobile accidents?
I don't know of an insurance company that's quite that specific, Justice Souter, and nor have I ever heard of labor union insurance. It's labor litigation insurance, so I'm not sure that such a market actually exists.
Neither do I.
Certainly, there's nothing on this record which would suggest so, sir.
Well, I just want to understand your position. Suppose there is a statewide contract for public employees, and one union brings a suit to interpret a provision of that collective bargaining agreement having to do with overtime or holidays or something. And then it notifies the other union, we're going to have to drop this litigation because we can't afford it, even though it ultimately may affect you down the line. You're not a party. I don't see the harm in allowing the other union to subsidize or contribute, you use whatever verb you want, to that litigation.
Well, of course, if the other
union... What harm are we trying to prevent here?
Well, obviously, First Amendment harm, Justice Kennedy, but I think... Understanding, if I understand your hypothetical,
the First Amendment can be a sword or a shield. This union wants to use it as a sword in order to protect its rights under the collective bargaining agreement. I don't see the harm.
Excuse me, Jessica. I'm sorry for interrupting you. Certainly, the union has the right to associate as it sees fit. The First Amendment protects that right. We're not suggesting that it doesn't have the right to go out and ask other labor unions to contribute to its litigation activities. What the First Amendment, the concomitant First Amendment right to not speak is involved when, in the words of the Ninth Circuit in one of these cases, they seek to mulch from the unwilling monies for their speech activities in a public forum.
But I don't understand about...
I'm sorry, Justice.
No, can finish because there's something.
Thank you, sir. And my point would be, under the hypothetical, as I understand it, you posed a union within the state under the same bargaining agreement being asked to support for litigation under one of the other locals. I can think of a number of cases where that's actually the case: two locals under one bargaining agreement. Just in my own experience, so you're not suggesting something that's unusual. I think under that circumstances, that would fall squarely within Ellis's rule. It involves the bargaining agreement. It may not involve the specific bargaining unit, but it is concerning the bargaining agreement.
Let's not fight the hypothetical. Let's say there are two bargaining agreements, but they're identical, and that this litigation that's underway will have persuasive force for the union that's thinking about entering. And then the union decides that it is going to enter. To help the union involved in the suit, and the members of the contributing union object, and you say they have a First Amendment right. That's your point.
Yes.
I don't see why the objects of collective bargaining, the objects of union, of the union, are not being fulfilled.
Because that goes beyond the free rider rationale which justifies the agency shop. In the earlier cases, such as Hansen and Street, the free rider that Congress was concerned with, and of course it's been adopted through Abood to apply to the states, the free rider that Congress was concerned with is the free rider who is required to accept the union services and refuses to subsidize those services. And this court, in discussing that in terms of lobbying and public relations activities, found that the relationship was too attenuated. Obviously, judicial decision making and administrative decision making is good for its persuasive effect in many different contexts, but that relationship was found to be too attenuated in Ellis with regard to litigation. And certainly, in Leonard, with regard to public relations
that's
lobbying.
That's the part I don't understand. And it's not your fault. I don't understand it in the cases either. What First Amendment right are we talking about? There's an individual who, under the agency shop, pays dues to a union. Now, suppose the union uses some of that money in a way that has nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with speech. But it doesn't happen to benefit that particular member. For example, you could have a central union headquarters 4,000 miles away where there's a librarian who's doing research on a matter that will help lots of people, but nobody in this area. Or you could have a program to commemorate the people who were hurt in the state of Hawaii at a union uprising or strike of some kind, where nobody in this particular area is ever going to go. Now, both of those activities are totally legitimate union activities that have nothing to do with politics. But this particular place won't benefit from them. Okay? What in the First Amendment prohibits the union from paying for such an activity out of general union dues assessed on everybody? And why would the First Amendment prohibit such a thing?
Under Leonard, Justice Breyer, the expenditures which you posit would be chargeable and are not at issue.
Fine. If they're chargeable because they have nothing to do with politics, perfectly legitimate, why isn't it also chargeable to pay for the cost of a lawsuit which has nothing to do with politics, totally for a union purpose? It just doesn't happen to benefit that person who's miles away in a different local.
Because benefit has never been the touchstone. And under Ellis and under Leonard and certainly the plurality.
I don't want you to tell me about cases. I'm abstracting from the — I want to know the reasoning. I want to know why.
Because we are talking about public — political speech of a public nature.
I said there is no politics in any of these expenditures. 42 bishops would swear there is nothing here that has anything to do with politics.
Why does it have to be political speech? Isn't it enough that it is simply speech that certain people don't want to subsidize?
Or
speech, so that the commemoration in Hawaii may be something that 99.99999% of the population would find very commendable, but someone is being forced to pay for that.
And I may
that's the reasoning that you seem to accept, and I guess all human activity is banned. Because to my knowledge, all human activity takes place through speech, with a few exceptions that are not irrelevant.
Well, it isn't banned. It just you don't force the non-union member, who indeed may be anti-union, to pay for it. And he doesn't want to subsidize the union librarian. He doesn't like unions here. He doesn't like unions in Hawaii. And for the government to force him to support the union is, I thought, part of the reasoning behind.
I'd be interested in your comment on this dialogue.
I'm sorry. I could jump in here somewhere, Justice Stevens. No, I appreciate the colloquy. And I think the distinction, getting back to the point Justice Alito raised, And the sharp distinction that has been made in the compelled speech and compelled dues cases is between the activities, certainly in the compelled union dues cases, is activities for which nonmembers are compelled to accept the union as bargaining representative.
But why isn't litigation, what I don't understand is how you draw a line between the negotiation of an agreement, where Leonard said this kind of pooling is okay, and the enforcement of the agreement. I mean, we're not talking about litigation unrelated to collective bargaining. It is only litigation that deals with the meaning of a term in the contract, whether what the employer has done is an unfair labor practice, whether there's been a contractual violation.
Justice Ginsburg, for the agreement, for the unit, we concede that the union may charge for that public speech of a political nature in a public forum. That we have no dispute over charging for enforcing enforcing the collective bargaining agreement. That is not our dispute. The dispute here is only over expenditures on behalf of other bargaining units, where we believe Ellis said it was too attenuated, but because it is not my point would be that the litigation which is acceptably chargeable, I think the default value in this Court's decision-making on litigation is that it's non-chargeable. However, the Court has drawn a narrow exception for that public speech in a public forum which is related to the union's duties as — not related to, but in performance of the union's duties as bargaining agent, the duties for which law imposes the union as a bargaining agent.
I don't understand why enforcing — one thing is making the agreement, and there you agree, as you must because of our Leonard decision, you can't have these pooling arrangements. What's the difference between negotiating an agreement and litigation to enforce it?
I think that would go back as far as Justice Marshall and Marbury. It would be an empty right if the union were able to negotiate an agreement it weren't permitted to enforce.
That's my point. I can't see the difference between saying pooling is okay when we're dealing with negotiating agreement, but it's not okay when we're dealing with enforcing.
The distinction is, Justice Ginsburg, that the negotiation of the agreement does not occur in a public forum, whereas litigation does. And that's the distinction
we would draw. I thought the distinction you were drawing was whether or not the collective bargaining agreement applies to the particular union. If it's a different unit with a different agreement, I thought you were saying that that can't be charged. But if it's the bargaining agreement that binds the particular unit, I thought you said that was chargeable.
Mr. Chief Justice, I'm sorry if I was confusing. I thought it was very specific. It is chargeable for litigation involving the bargaining agreement. We don't dispute
that. Of
the particular unit. That is not in dispute here.
And I suppose you would also concede that if the bargaining agreement is exactly the same, a number of units have exactly the same bargaining agreement, which I would suppose is a not uncommon situation, that litigation with respect to the terms of the bargaining agreement, even though it happens to involve a different unit, is also chargeable to the particular.
No, Mr. Chief Justice, we would not concede that. We believe that this Court in Ellis drew a bright line. I think that's clear in Ellis's discussion of the Mutual Aid Pact, which was not chargeable in Ellis, found not chargeable in Ellis. The distinction that I think this Court has drawn, or that should, I would respectfully suggest, should be drawn, is a narrow one. It's consistent with strict scrutiny and this Court's jurisprudence in that area. Only for speech which is narrowly related to the union's duties as bargaining agent and performance of those duties can charging non-members for public political speech in a public forum.
That means, I just want to be sure, you exclude the librarian example of Justice Breyer.
The librarian, I think, would fall under the general Leonard test.
Well, which side is, though? I want you have to be clear with me.
There were a lot of sides there, Justice Stevens.
I understand you'd be saying they could not charge the non-member for the expenses of the Hawaiian librarian.
I think it was the Hawaiian commemoration that Justice Breyer referred to that I think I had to rethink because it was a public speech in a public forum. The librarian researching bargaining issues at the union headquarters in downtown Washington or, well, in downtown Washington at the international affiliate. I think it's chargeable.
The librarian in Hawaii researching something that the plaintiff has no interest in spending money on. Can that be prohibited?
Well, here we're, Justice Stevens, we're simply talking about, of course, the international affiliate. As far as cross-unit affiliation, I'm not sure. I think that would fall under, again, General Leonard's general test.
Could you tell us two hypotheticals? One is the librarian. Two is the public celebration. Participating unions be allowed to contribute to either of those activities?
Well, of course they'd be allowed to. Can they force non-members?
Would there have to be a proration?
The public.
A with the librarian, B with the celebration.
The public celebration, no. The librarian, I believe so, yes.
You have several times mentioned the public forum as having a significance in drawing the line, and I'm not sure that I follow you there. Why do you do that?
Well, I think, Justice Souter, that arises from the court's determinations on things like public relations and lobbying, and the distinction it makes, the distinction, for instance, in Leonard, between the teacher's voice articles and the Preserve Public Education program. The distinction drawn from that, differing results, is that internal union communications regarding non-political matters were treated as chargeable by the majority of this court, and where the outward-looking speech activities were treated as non-chargeable.
Let me ask you this. If an employer and a union local decided that, you know, they'd really let the sun shine in and they would conduct their collective bargaining in a theater with microphones and anybody could drop in and hear, would that change the chargeability of as against the dissenting non-members?
No, Justice Souter, because the speech would still be directed at the public employer, not exward-looking. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Collins?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, when this court in Abood describe the kinds of expenditures that bargaining agents are required to engage in and that necessitate a rule that requires all represented employees, including objecting non-members, to pay their share, services of lawyers is what the court first mentioned. The single narrow question presented in this case is whether a local bargaining agent that's confronted with the need to pay for those services of lawyers, to draw upon legal expertise in bargaining-related matters, is required to go it alone, rely solely on its own resources and its own expertise, or
but
whether —
that's not what we're talking about. It doesn't have to go it alone. It simply can't force members of another unit that can decide they're happy to support it, but the members who don't want to support it, who don't like unions, they can't be forced to pay for it if it does not relate to their collective bargaining agreement.
But the question, Mr. Chief Justice, is whether that, I should add, if that unit wants to neither go it alone nor give a free ride to objecting non-members, can it avail itself?
If the litigation is not germane to the unit where people object, to that unit's collective bargaining agreement, they're not free riding on anything.
They're free riding on the same thing that Leonard says they cannot free ride on. Leonard, as Mr. Young acknowledges, certainly holds that as a general proposition, when a local union bargaining agent is determining how to finance germane expenditures that it will incur, germane to its unit, it can either obviously go it alone, rely on its own resources, or it can enter into an affiliation relationship where it will pay an affiliation fee, the amount of which will be measured by the total chargeable expenditures incurred by the national union in other bargaining units as well as in the local's own unit. What Leonard teaches is that that situation cannot fairly be described as requiring the objecting nonmember to subsidize other units.
What if there's no — and I guess I'm getting into the Solicitor General's position here. What if the unit with the objecting members does not have a right to call upon the pool, either — or has never called upon the pool, and it's unlikely that it will? Isn't there — it's not simply — subsidization, it's their compelled fees being used for something that doesn't benefit their collective bargaining arrangement.
There are three problems with that contention by the Solicitor General, which the petitioners have adopted for the first time in their reply brief. The first problem is precisely that. It was not raised in the Court of Appeals. It's not raised in the petition for certiorari. The second problem, I should add, it's never been raised in any other post-Leonard case. And I think the reason that this issue is not being raised is that it's understood, I think correctly, that Leonard itself did not involve a situation where the kind of showing that the Solicitor General and now the petitioners would require. In Leonard, where this Court did approve pooling of a wide range of expenses, the Court simply referred to the fact that the union in that case had a unified membership structure, which, as the Court put it, under which so many unions operate. And the Court talked about the essence of an affiliation relationship being that locals can draw on international for services. But there was no record, there was no showing, there was no finding, there was no discussion of any notion that the local union in Leonard had an enforceable right
what
for
if,
any
well,
part
exactly.
of cases.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say exactly. So I regard that issue as still open. It was not addressed at all in Leonard.
It was raised in the reply brief in Leonard. The petitioners in Leonard complained that a problem with pooling is that there are no guarantees and no standards. That's why there's a discussion, it's reflected in Justice Scalia's separate opinion, a discussion of the fact that it was acknowledged that there's no contractual relationship, but that there were certain customs and practices. But there was no evidence and certainly no determination by this Court.
Well, what did the Court mean in Leonard when it said there must be some indication that the payment is for service that may ultimately inure to the benefit of members of the local union by virtue of their membership in the parent organization?
What the Court meant by that, I believe, Justice Ginsburg, is that we look at the examples the Court gave of what does not inure. The Court referred to certain kinds of payments a local union could make which are not part of an affiliation fee payment. The Court talked about direct payments to other locals. The other example given was a payment to a national union that wasn't required by affiliation but was like a charitable contribution. What the Court did not dispute in Leonard is that to the extent that an affiliation fee is providing a pool of resources used by the national union for otherwise chargeable services, the potential availability of those services does satisfy the inurement requirement.
Well, suppose that the one or more locals someplace else in the country are involved in very, very expensive litigation, and as a result, the international assesses all of the locals a fee to pay for that litigation. But at the same time, adopts a position that it is extremely unlikely in the future that the international will ever subsidize any other local union litigation expenses. Would a local union not involved in that litigation, would it be permissible for them to charge their non-members?
If it were a special assessment for a specific purpose, I think it is not embraced by Leonard's rationale. It might well not be chargeable because what Leonard does not arise in a vacuum. Leonard talks about the typical affiliation fee relationship. And there have been various submissions, treatise articles about that. So the notion is that a national union charges an affiliation fee for all of the various services it provides, and local unions can draw upon those resources as needed. If you then talk about a special assessment.
If you concede that, then aren't you conceding there has to be some standard under which to assess whether the local union that is being required to pay the fee for extra unit litigation expenses is getting something back in return?
I think not, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, I do think that Leonard did approve.
It's not necessary for there to be any standard under which to assess that they're getting anything back in return. If it's clear they're not getting anything back in return, it's still okay.
Not beyond, and again, the question isn't presented, but not beyond what Leonard found necessary. Leonard found it important, and I would say necessary, to its decision that the union in that case had what Leonard described as a typical unified membership affiliation fee arrangement. And it talked about a typical affiliation fee where locals pay money to go to the pooled, otherwise chargeable expenditures of the national union.
So if you have a situation where there's a provision in the collective bargaining agreement that the union thinks requires the employer to provide air conditioning in the plant, the local up in Nome, Alaska, has to support that extra unit litigation, even though it will never have any benefit for it?
Just as Leonard plainly holds, that local would have to support the negotiation of that provision in the first place in Nome, Alaska. That's the holding of Leonard. The question is whether litigation is different, and there is no way that litigation is different in any principled way as relates to pooling.
I didn't think Leonard held that the unit would have to support that type of extra unit litigation. I mean,
It was litigation over?
Yes. Yeah, there's a provision which is ambiguous, which frequently happens, and the union says that requires air conditioning, and the company says no, and there's a big fight about that.
Well, I think my answer is still correct. Leonard does not hold, does not provide the answer as to litigation, but Leonard says if the union in the first instance says we want to go to Nome, Alaska and negotiate something about air conditioning, that even though it only affects the unit in Nome, Alaska, becomes part of the pool of chargeable expenditures that all units can be required.
Well, sure, because that negotiation is germane to the Nome, Alaska collective bargaining agreement if they're negotiating it there for that unit.
But the litigation is equally germane. Petitioners do not dispute that litigation can be germane and chargeable within a particular unit. They acknowledge that. There's no dispute about that. So both the negotiation of the air conditioning right in Nome, Alaska, and the enforcement of that negotiated agreement through litigation are equally germane within the unit. The same interests.
But aren't they equally chargeable? Isn't the unspoken premise of your argument and what Leonard was getting at? They're not only germane, but isn't there an unspoken premise that just as the union will support the union of the dissident objector in negotiating a collective bargaining agreement, the union will also presumably support them if litigation is necessary later on to enforce it. So that the so-called standard by which the union's obligation to support the litigation in the unit that includes the dissident is not somehow precisely spelled out, the assumption is that they do have some obligation to support the litigation if it comes to the dissident's unit. And isn't that the point of your argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I want to make clear, when the court spoke in Leonard of the essence of an affiliation agreement. An affiliation agreement is a contractual relationship. We would certainly view that as creating a covenant of good and fair faith and fair dealing that a national union will deal fairly with its various
which
units.
Which includes a covenant in effect of support.
That's correct. And it's actually quite analogous in that regard to the duty of fair representation that, let's say, an unaffiliated local union owns to its objecting non-members.
So you think there's a covenant of support? You have however many, 1,000 individual units. You think each of those, you have a covenant to support them when they all get involved in separate litigation? You can't possibly.
No, but Mr. Chief Justice, what I said was a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that...
Well, so it's quite unlike, for example, insurance. If you have insurance and you and the unit have a particular litigation, you have a right to have that covered. There's no similar right here.
That's correct, Your Honor. The First Amendment does not create a rate-setting rule for unions. And the reason for that —
Okay, so there's no covenant of support. There is what? A covenant of support if the litigation in the local unit that includes the dissident has wide significance and therefore could affect other units? Is that what the obligation is?
No, Justice Souter,
Is there any obligation at all? You said, okay, there's an obligation of some kind of fair dealing. Given the question that we've got, that doesn't matter unless the fair dealing relates at some point to support for litigation, right?
But the national union.
And how do we articulate what that obligation is? If it's not a covenant to support, regardless of what the litigation is, how do we articulate what the degree of the obligation to support is?
The way I would articulate it, and then I'd like to take a step backward and compare it to the non-affiliated situation, but I would articulate it as follows, that there is not any First Amendment requirement that there is, in reality, in the affiliation agreement, simply a covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that one local will be treated with respect to litigation needs as others would be treated.
Yeah, but the trouble with saying that is exactly the point that the Chief Justice raised. You don't take the position that no matter what the litigation is, the parent union has got to support it. Therefore, how do we identify the litigation that they will support? How do we know that they have any obligation at all?
They don't have a First Amendment obligation, but, Your Honor, that is true in the case of agency fees altogether. We have to take a step back and remember that we are trying to perform an exercise, which the Court has said can't be done to perfection, of trying to distinguish between making individuals who object support collective bargaining activities, not support other things. In Hudson itself, in the basic situation, let's assume there's no affiliation agreement, simply a local union. A fee is charged based on the percentage of expenses in the prior year that went for chargeable activities, including, let's say, litigation. That creates no guarantee that in the year that we're now in, when fees are being paid, that if litigation is demanded, requested by a non-member or anyone else, that local union will provide.
Well, it doesn't create a guarantee expressed like the terms of an insurance policy, but there is, in fact, a local practice to which one can refer. And it would seem reasonable in a case like that to say, okay, you can force the dissident to pay a fair share on the expectation that the same kind of enforcement litigation will take place if there's a dispute this year or next year. We don't have, as I understand it, a clear sort of expectation standard when we're talking about affiliation agreements that involve a parent and many, many other locals. And the point here, is, it seems to me, is to determine whether there is any obligation at all, whether the dissident is getting anything or can expect to get anything for the fee. And what I want to know is, how do we describe that obligation?
I think at most the obligation is parallel to the duty of fair representation in the sense that the entity that's responsible for determining what services are going to be provided to the employees has to treat, in the case of the local union, members and non-members in the unit equally. In the case of the national union, it's a different affiliated entities fairly.
So we're talking about an infringement on the objecting members' First Amendment rights, and your answer is, trust us, we'll treat you fairly. I understand it. It's a different answer if you say, you've got a right. We can impose the contribution requirement on you even though you object to it because under this agreement you have a right to call upon our services. And that's a different case. But if your answer is simply, trust us, we'll treat you fairly, that's not the usual standard we apply to infringements of First Amendment rights.
But I have two answers to that, Mr. Chief Justice. First, it is essentially the answer that's supplied under Hudson, where the Court says simply use the prior year's percentages. We don't know whether this year will have the same percentage breakdown. We also don't know whether this year the union will have enough money to provide any particular service or not. But
that's a little bit more stringent than trust us. It's saying let's look at last year and figure it out.
Well, but we look at the national union typical affiliation type arrangement, as the Court described it in Leonard, and what we understand is this is a union, it's not making a profit. It's not piling up fees and putting them somewhere. It exists to provide services to local affiliates. Those affiliates, if they are not provided with services, it's not just the non-member, the objector, who's being harmed. The members want those services.
But couldn't the national say, local, you have asked for assistance with such and such litigation. We think your case is what this court sometimes calls a bad vehicle. We don't want to finance your litigation. The issue is important, and we are going to wait for a case that presents it in a better light. It's more likely to win.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's one thing a national union can properly do. Another thing a national union can properly do is to say, we've just had an unexpected economic crisis. All of a sudden, midterm, we have to change our priorities, and we're going to have to protect people from a lot of layoffs. But the second
point, the issue is not whether that's a fair thing for the national union to do. The issue is whether the person who is being compelled against his will to pay dues to the union is getting anything back for that compelled payment. And even though the national union may be acting in an entirely fair fashion given its national objectives, compelled payment is not doing what our cases seem to say it must do. He has to be paying for services rendered.
What the value the objector is getting, he does not have a guarantee of services. He has the potential for services far beyond what could ever be paid for out of the local zone affiliation fees. And I would add, if a national union were to act in some improper way in terms of how it doles out assistance, and by the way, one doesn't see cases on this. It's really not in the nature of how national unions operate because, again, we're talking about members and non-members equally in terms of who's going to get benefits. So it's not a problem in the real world of national unions treating a particular local unfairly for some reason and not giving them services that are given to others. There are certainly a lot of judgments involved, as Justice Ginsburg's question elicited. But if a national union were to treat affiliates unfairly, it's quite possible that if and when that occurred, it might have implications under a number of possible causes of actions, and including possibly the right to object. Justice Scalia's opinion in Leonard noted that if and when services aren't provided, there might be ground for objection. The question here is there a basis under the First Amendment to have a prophylactic rule that says we are so concerned that even though we have no rule under Hudson that provides assurance that an unaffiliated local union will provide any particular services to its members and non-members, we have such a concern that somehow national unions won't deliver the goods, that we're going to set up a hierarchy of either guarantees, standards, which, if the issue had been presented here and we had created a record, we would show the court, I think no union in this country has, and for good reason, both because of the virtual infinitude of legitimate factors one could consider, also because of the constant changes in needs of local unions.
If certain fees are being assessed on the theory that this is a pooling arrangement, I don't understand why you're resisting any effort to impose any standards or any inquiry as to whether it's really a pooling arrangement.
Because, Your Honor, and the reason I started my argument by saying there's really two choices, a local union goes it alone or has the arrangement that we have here, is that it simply would not be possible in the nature of things to have a set of standards and guarantees that would be that would be meaningful in any way to govern how national unions provide services to locals. A standard of basic fairness and equal treatment is one thing, but to try to say, and one could tick off, I suppose, 50 things we'll consider. We'll consider whether it's going to be an important precedent, whether it's the kind of thing a local really can't afford on its own, whether it's important now that we have pressing economic problems and everyone's being laid off. Is this a good test case or a bad test case? How broad will the implications of this be? One could list 50 factors, but they wouldn't guide any inquiry in
so
a meaningful
you're,
way.
So if we determine as a matter of First Amendment law that such a requirement is necessary, then you lose because you're saying we can't possibly fashion
it. Then we lose, and so does the union and Leonard lose. It was acknowledged that there was nothing like that.
Well, Leonard didn't address the question of litigation.
Well, but there's been no argument made that would explain why, if one can pool, if the union negotiates an agreement with a very controversial provision that a non-member has a very legitimate objection to, Leonard holds that can be pooled.
But
Leonard does not say that standards.
Your argument seems to be that the whole analogy of a pooling arrangement is invalid. That was unrealistic, because there really is no way of telling whether any of these things is a pooling arrangement. There's no standard that could possibly be articulated that would be meaningful to determine whether something that is labeled a pooling arrangement really is in any way a pooling arrangement. That seems to be your argument. That would seem to cut against the whole idea of pooling arrangements, not only for litigation expenses, but for everything else.
I have two responses to that, Justice Alito. First, if one had to have the kinds of either guarantees or meaningful, enforceable standards that are implied in your question, then in the nature of the beast, it could not be done by national unions, and we would be in a system then when all that can happen is that a local union has to rely solely on its own resources, solely on its own expertise, and it's doing that despite, as Judge Lynch pointed out in the concurrence, despite the dire impact that can have on its ability to represent people, and it's doing it.
Well, it doesn't have to do that. It can use the money of its union members any way it wants. It can contribute to the national. All of their money, if it wishes. We're only talking about that portion of the union income, which comes from people who don't want to join the union.
Well, then it either has to allow free. If the union has to either conclude we're going to support all of our germane activities, all of our chargeable activities through our own funding and our own resources, and if that's just inadequate and therefore it's litigation needs to be conducted, we can't do it. The employer knows that, so it can take advantage of us in bargaining. We're just going to have to live with it, or we can say our members will pay for that, but the non-members won't, because the only solution, other than using the local's own money, is to pay a fee to the national. And as I've indicated, in Leonard, as in this case, the arrangement is not one that provides guarantees.
Well, one of the difficulties, it seemed to me, of the petitioner's position was it's a sort of all-or-nothing approach. But you seem to be taking the mirror position of that. Your argument is sounding all or nothing on your side. I don't get much help from either side as to what the standard ought to be. I know germane is obviously a malleable word, but we're looking to see if there's some test that we can use. It's not all or nothing. And well, I haven't heard from either side yet what that would be.
The question of Justice Kennedy is, whatever the test is, if it's satisfied as to expenditures within the unit where the services are provided, can those services be pooled, or is there a different test that has to be applied to the pooling? My submission is that Leonard makes clear there's no separate test. As to what the test is within, and therefore, as to the question presented here, one doesn't need to decide on the actual test that will be applied within the local, because as your separate opinion and Justice Scalia's separate opinion in Leonard made clear, even under the narrower statutory duties test, there could still be pooling. The definition as to what can be pooled would simply be different. I'll only note on the question of whether the test should be germaneness with the two additional prongs as held in Leonard or the statutory duties test, that, again, is a question that's not presented here. As I've just indicated, it doesn't affect the concept of pooling. There's also been no confusion, contrary to petitioner's contention, under the Leonard test. The only issue that's given the Court's difficulties is a specific issue here as to why the plurality in Leonard seemed to indicate that litigation might be in a different status under pooling. So there's no basis in this case for reconsidering the basic Leonard test of chargeability. I will simply note, however, that the statutory duties test, for which petitioners argue, really doesn't make the situation clearer than the germaneness test, because the government, both the germaneness test and the statutory duties test acknowledge that the union's right to charge non-objecting non-members stems from its function as exclusive bargaining representative. But there's no way to sustain logically the notion that that means that only those things that are done in that exclusive representative capacity are chargeable, because the same government interests that allow for charging when the union is acting as the exclusive bargaining agent have to also allow for charging for those things that are necessary in order for the union to play that role and to enforce that role, which includes things like the headquarters. It includes things like litigation to enforce an agreement, even though in those areas, when performing those functions, the union very often does not have an exclusive representational duty or duty of fair representation.
Is there a rule or a reg or somewhere in the Labor Department that says if the national union takes the money from its locals, spends it in a way, has nothing to do with politics whatsoever, zero, but either wastes it or they build too big a building or they do something that doesn't benefit local number 432, does local 432 have any remedy?
There's no Labor Department regulation.
There's no remedy at all.
No, and I've never
seen it. So the union members who are being gypped, they just have to put up.
No, I would say there'd be a breach of a covenant of good faith and fair dealing under the affiliation relationship in some of those situations. And, of course, if a union used an illegal basis for determining when it would provide services,
well, there could be a problem. Are you saying you could bring a lawsuit or not?
You could bring a lawsuit alleging that the union had violated its covenant of good faith and fair dealing to its affiliates. If the union acted on the basis of, say, race, for example, you could certainly bring a lawsuit.
All right. So either in these cases, everybody in the union, whether they're forced or not, has this kind of remedy, or nobody does. That's your
right. And the reason for that is what we always have to understand here is that the interests in seeing to it that a local union that pays an affiliation fee will receive services in a fair way from the national is an interest that's shared equally by the members and the non-members. It's not something that creates a First Amendment concern.
Oh, well, that's not right. I mean, again, you have to postulate we're dealing with non-members who don't like unions at all. So while the members may think this is perfectly fair, the non-members think whenever their money is forced to be used for union activities, it's unfair.
But a member equally with a non-member, Mr. Chief Justice, would have the view that if it's predictable year after year that for some reason his local just doesn't get services from the national union just sends it elsewhere, that member is going to be no more happy than the non-member. That's why those things don't happen in the real world. That's why we don't need a prophylactic rule, and why there's certainly no First Amendment basis for a prophylactic rule that requires a union to establish what no union in this country, to my knowledge, has, which is either a clear guarantee or specific standards for providing services.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Young, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I think it's appropriate to note the apocalyptic predictions that are suggested from the rule that the petitioners are advancing are avoidable by easily readily available alternatives. International unions would, of course, be free to make loans to local affiliates engaged in massive litigation or other speech activities where they think it's appropriate. The alternative is not between prohibiting pooling arrangements which have no standards, no enforceability, and no predictability, and allowing the non-members to become free riders on legitimate litigation expenditures funded through the international affiliate. The choice is between a malleable, unpredictable, and ultimately unenforceable agreement and a standard which would allow the international to subsidize such litigation and allow only the cost of that litigation to be extracted from non-members.
In the case that says that a union member, person forced into the union, agency shop, and I guess a lawyer who has to pay to be an integrated bar, and I guess a doctor who has to join a medical association, the case that says that these people have a First Amendment right to get back money that's being wasted is what?
We don't suggest that there is such a right, Justice.
Oh, so unless it's political in your view, you don't have that right?
Unfortunately, no, Justice Breyer.
The test is not whether it's political, is it? It's not a negative test, as long as it's an affirmative requirement in which the burden is on the union that they have to show the expenditure is germane to the particular collective bargaining agreement.
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, that's exactly correct. And the test in determining whether or not it is can be charged across bargaining lines is a bright-line test of whether it is a speech activity.
Well, do you have a response to Justice Kennedy's concern? Do you have a fallback position, or are you also in the all or nothing?
I'm afraid you've got two principled advocates before you, Mr. Chief Justice, who are holding firm to their positions. I would, however, like to address one more point. I think it's appropriate to recall, get us back again to the focus on this is compelled speech subject to this court's strict scrutiny jurisprudence. The test suggested by MSEA is that a union's activities are subject to the duty of fair representation and to the covenant of good faith and fair dealing under the duty of fair representation, which of course is that wide range of reasonableness, cannot be sustained where this court's standard is the least restrictive means.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.